As of July 1st, 2025, applications are open for the Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for spring 2026. Immerse yourself in the Catholic intellectual tradition and experience profound opportunities for spiritual formation in the heart of the Church. Applications close August 15th. Learn more and apply at www.thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
The outline for this talk, I'll start by talking about Catholic teaching on what it refers to as responsible parenthood. Then I'll look at two distinctions that the Catholic Church makes. The first between permissible and impermissible means of avoiding pregnancy. The second between what it refers to as direct contraception and sterilization and indirect contraception and sterilization. And then I'll conclude with looking at the Catholic reasoning, so the why behind the teaching. So to begin, Catholic teaching, responsible parenthood. So the Catholic understanding of marriage is that it involves the total self-giving of the spouses to each other, a self-gift, which is both unitive and procreative. This is something that the Church sees is lived out by the spouses in all aspects of their life, and is lived out in a particular way through sexual intercourse in marriage. And so in terms of the procreative nature of the conjugal act, then, and the link there to marriage, then the Catholic Church sees children as a great good in marriage. And couples are called to participate in God's fruitful love in this way and having children and being co-creators with God in this way. So certainly it's the case that Catholic couples are called to have children. The Catechism, quoting a document from the Second Vatican Council, Gaudium et Spes, says this: by its very nature, the institution of marriage and married love is ordered to the procreation and education of the offspring, and is in them that it finds its crowning glory. So this is certainly understood to be one of the purposes of marriage in the Catholic Church. But that does not mean that the Church teaches that couples must have as many children as they physically can. So first answer, first survey question was false. So that's not the teaching of the Catholic Church. But rather, the Catholic Church calls couples to what it refers to as responsible parenthood. So it's a phrase coming from Humanae Vitae, which is an encyclical letter written by Pope Paul VI in 1968. And this letter, we'll actually talk a good amount about it. So you'll see it has to do with, in particular, it focuses on the procreative end of marriage and sexual intercourse within marriage. So it calls couples to responsible parenthood. So Humanae Vitae outlines four components of responsible parenthood. So the first component is that couples should have an awareness of and a respect for the proper functions of biological processes. Doesn't specify the biological processes, but given that it's talking about procreation, probably what Paul VI has in mind is sexual and reproductive biological processes. So I think that's what it has in mind here. So couples are called to be aware of and respect the natural, the proper functions of the biological processes. Second component is that couples should have control. They should exercise control of the reason and the will over innate drives and emotions. Again, doesn't specify which drives and emotions it's talking about, but again, probably it has in mind sexual drive, emotion of love, love of spouse, and also maybe in some cases, love of having children. Third step talks about a prudential discernment based on, it lists specifically physical, economic, psychological, and social conditions. So prudential discernment, looking at all these different factors, and the decision, the discernment, can go in one of two ways. On the one hand, the couple might, quote, generously decide to have more children. So certainly the Catholic Church emphasizes the goodness, the generosity involved in Catholic couples who do have big families. But the Catholic Church also recognizes that based on all these different factors, that couples might decide that it's not prudent for them right now to have additional children. And it says for either a certain or for an indefinite time. I think the word prudential, so prudent is the word, prudently, I think is the variation on that word that Humanae Vitae uses, is really important for sort of beginning to understand this. So in relation to the fact that couples are called to have children, right? So how do we fit these two things together? They're called to have children unless they decide it's not prudent for them, right? So if you think about prudence as a virtue, right? So prudence is the virtue which helps us to know the true good in the circumstances and the right means of achieving it. So the relevant goods here certainly involve procreation and also other goods of the family, the good of the family and other goods of the family, right? And so when we talk about promoting certain goods, it's not just a question of promoting them at all costs, right? So think about the good of health, for instance. Certainly there are things that we should do to promote our health, but that doesn't mean, at least I hope it doesn't, right, that we exercise every chance we get or that we exercise at least 2 hours a day. Maybe that would be the best thing for our health. Probably would be, right? But with prudence, right, with prudential discernment, we understand that there are other goods in our lives that we need to pursue. In order to support other goods, sometimes we can't exercise every day or maybe even every other day. So it's prudence that's required for this discernment. So it's looking at the goods, all the goods involved, and also these other factors in order to determine whether it be prudent to have more children or not to in this moment. The fourth component, Humanitate says, involves discernment based on the objective moral order, which is established by God. Keeping a right order of priorities, recognize their own duties toward God, themselves, families, and society. Ensure that what they do corresponds to the will of God, the Creator. So the way I think about the difference between the third and the fourth components, since they both involve this sort of discernment, I think about the third step as sort of, you know, discernment based on these different factors in the couple's life. But then the fourth step is reminding them to take it to God in prayer, right? So, you know, what are they sort of thinking just based on prudential judgment? But then also, what does God think about they're thinking about it, right? So that's how I think about it, is also putting God in the conversation. So just as an example here, I think that it could be the case that a couple might decide that it would be prudent, maybe, or it would be in keeping with prudence not to have additional children right now. Maybe it's permissible for them to avoid having children, but maybe they feel like God is actually calling them to have a child, right, in this circumstance. So I think difference between what's permissible and what's best might also be at play here. So the question comes up, how serious do the reasons need to be, right? So that was one of maybe the second survey question, right, that if the couple doesn't have grave reasons. So that's a term that you might have heard, that couples need to have grave reasons. So where does that term come from? Well, it comes from not the official translation of Humanae Vitae, and seems to be coming from the Italian translation. But there's a good argument to be made that it's a false cognate. So the Italian word grave translated into English, well, the official English version might help us to understand better what it's supposed to mean. So the official English translation is well-grounded reasons. So the English word grave takes on a weightier sense than the Italian word does. And the same is true in the Latin translation as well, that it's less weighty than grave is in English. So that word does get used because of that false cognate. So some translations, not official translations of Humanae Vitae, do use that word. But it seems like there's a good argument to be made that that's not the intended sense of the word. The Catechism uses the term just reason. So I think well-grounded or just reasons, I think they're communicating a similar level of weightiness. So there can't be frivolous reasons, right? There can't be selfish reasons. But if they're just reasons, if they're well-grounded reasons, then this is what is required for a couple to intend to avoid pregnancy. Well, what counts as well-grounded? What counts as just reasons? Most people want a list, right, of what would constitute that. The church doesn't give us a list. And I think it's intentional. I think it's intentional. I don't think the church ever will. So sometimes the church doesn't have teaching on something and we're just waiting for it, right? But and it takes like thousands of years sometimes. But in this case, I don't think there's going to be a list. And part of the reason is because I think it would be maybe impossible to articulate a reason that applies the same way in all circumstances. Because the particulars of the couple's situation can really affect, right? Even the same situation. So I don't know, this is coming to mind now. So say that, the husband loses his job, right? Or say, the husband is without a job. So you list that, okay, if it's the breadwinner loses his job, his or her job, right? Then that's a just reason. Okay, well, what if they have this family inheritance, right? Well, that's a very different situation, right? So the circumstances, the particulars of the situation have to factor in here. And the couple, they're the ones who know best what all those different factors are. And so the Catholic Church, I would say, entrusts the decision, gives the responsibility of the decision to the couple. They should have a well-formed conscience. I think they should seek counsel. But ultimately, it's their judgment in conversation with God. So if couples have well-grounded or just reasons to avoid having children, then how permissibly may they avoid having children? So Humanae Vitae, again, that encyclical by Paul VI in 1968, says this: if therefore there are well-grounded reasons for spacing births arising from the physical or psychological condition of husband or wife, or from external circumstances, the Church teaches that married people may then take advantage of the natural cycles imminent in the reproductive system and engage in marital intercourse only during those times that they are infertile, thus controlling birth in a way which does not in the least offend the moral principles which we have just explained. So I emphasize 1968 because in 1968, the only method that would have fallen under this would be the calendar method, or the otherwise called the rhythm method. People joke about it for a reason. It's not effective. So it's really interesting to me to think about just how the situation has changed, given that today we have multiple methods of highly effective, what we refer to as natural family planning methods, or sometimes called fertility awareness methods, methods that are as effective as birth control in avoiding pregnancy. And so the situation, again, it's following the same principles of taking advantage of the natural cycles imminent in the reproductive system, engaging in marital intercourse only during those times that they are infertile. So just very briefly here, and we can talk more about it if you're interested. So in case you guys don't know, men are fertile all the time. Women are not. So the natural cycles, we're talking about the woman's reproductive cycle in particular and how she's sometimes fertile and sometimes not. Most of the time, she's not fertile. And so the calendar method just sort of takes this perfect cycle and says, okay, you're not fertile from, or you are fertile from, roughly 6 days before day 14 to a day or two after that. And so you should avoid sex during that time, right? Because that's when you would conceive. The problem is that women don't have perfect cycles. Even women who do have a regular cycle, ovulation can shift within even that very regular cycle. So modern methods of natural family planning, fertility awareness methods, what they do is they track certain biomarkers. So some of them track cervical mucus, some of them track basal body temperature, some of them track hormones that shift during the woman's reproductive cycle. And so with tracking, the woman can have a very accurate understanding of where she is in her cycle. And this goes for women who have regular as well as irregular cycles as well. And so again, by taking advantage of that natural cycle, which God made it such that women are not fertile most of the time, couples can engage in marital intercourse only during the times when they are infertile. So they can still engage in intercourse during this time in their marriage, but also avoid pregnancy at the same time. In contrast, this is how Humanae Vitae defines what it refers to as impermissible means of avoiding pregnancy. Also, I'm using the term that the tradition sometimes uses, direct contraception or sterilization. So note right away that the definition I'm going to give is a moral description. It's not necessarily a medical description. Maps on medically, but it's a moral description, right? So says any action which either before, at the moment of, or after sexual intercourse that is specifically intended to prevent procreation, whether as an end or as a means. So the key here is the specific intention to prevent procreation. Father Nicanor Ostriaco, Dominican priest, his textbook Biomedicine Beatitude, he gives the phrasing, which I find helpful, maybe you will too, that the specific intention is to render a fertile act infertile. So when we say that sexual intercourse is a fertile act, we don't mean that it always, or even for the most part, it's actually improbable. It's less than 50% chance. So it's not the case that it always or most of the time results in procreation, but it's that it's the kind of act that is apt for procreation. It's the kind of act which is naturally ordered to procreation. So to give something of an analogy, if you think about like the human eye, we think about the human eye as being naturally ordered towards seeing, even if in the individual, that person cannot see, right? The eye still is naturally ordered in that way. So the analogy here, again, is that sexual intercourse has this natural ordering by God's design towards procreation. So the problematic piece here that Humanitas is pointing to is that these methods, which fall under direct contraception sterilization, seek to prevent pregnancy or to, in Father Nicanor's words, to render a fertile act infertile. Okay, so just to give some sense of what we're talking about here, I think just because it's going to be helpful in terms of understanding the reasoning as well. So it says before, at the moment of, or after, right? So before, and then it also says whether man or woman, permanent or temporary, right? So we can think of on the woman's side, before she's taking oral contraceptives, right, or an IUD, both very popular, that are more temporary, or if she has a tubal ligation, which is more permanent. Those are all done before. After, you think about like the morning after pill. The moment of, probably things like barrier methods come into play here. Man, again, let's see. Before, we don't really have male contraceptives because men didn't like the side effects, so they let the women bear the burden. But at the moment of, again, barrier methods or withdrawal method, after, I guess before, maybe vasectomy, right, for long term. Okay, so all these methods fall under this moral act, this moral object, this moral description. Note that at least one of the methods I mentioned is natural. It's not something man-made, right? So the withdrawal method is natural, is a natural method, right? So it's not an artificial method in the sense of it's not man-made. But so that goes to clarify that they're not wrong because they're artificial. There's plenty of artificial things that we all enjoy and the Catholic Church, you know, has no problem enjoying, right? So it's not the fact that they're artificial that's problematic. It's the fact that they act against the natural ordering of the act. So they're contrary to the natural ordering, that's what's problematic, not the fact that they're not found in nature. Okay, so just different understanding of what we mean by natural, right? Okay, so whether man or woman, whether permanent or temporary, all of the actions that fall under this, the Catholic teaching is very clear. If you look at Humanae Vitae, also in the Catechism, where the Church specifically says that these are intrinsically wrong. And when we talk about intrinsically wrong actions, that means that they're wrong for all times and for all places, regardless of any good intention or difficult circumstances. They're always wrong. Okay, but at this point, you might be now a little confused, right? So we said Catholic couples can avoid pregnancy, but they can't prevent pregnancy. They can't render a fertile act infertile. And I think it's common that it's sort of hard to see the difference here, that natural family planning methods seem kind of just like birth control, just like the natural version of it. But in the Catholic tradition, there is a clear moral distinction between direct contraception or sterilization and natural family planning used to avoid pregnancy. I find it helpful to break it down in terms of the three parts of moral action. So Catholic tradition, including in Thomas Aquinas, when it analyzes the morality of an action, it looks at these three parts of moral action: the object, the intention, and the circumstances. So the object answers the question, what is the acting person doing? The intention involves this sort of subjective intention, so why is the person doing it? And then the circumstances, so we have the what, the why, and then the circumstances are all the other who, where, when, how, all the other questions, right, fall under circumstances. And in the Catholic tradition as well, so we look at these three parts of the action. In order for an action to be morally good or permissible, all of these parts of the action have to be good for the act to be good. And so if we compare direct contraception and sterilization to NFP, looking at these three parts of moral action, I think might help to clarify the moral difference. So first, the object here, again, what is the person doing? Sometimes the question here is asked, what is the per se ordering of the act? So what is the end towards which the act is inherently or naturally ordered? And so I think, again, that language of preventing pregnancy by rendering a fertile act infertile, I think that's a good description here of the moral object for direct contraception, sterilization. On the other hand, natural family planning. So what is being done? Well, there's an avoiding pregnancy, right? But it's done through knowledge, using the language from responsible parenthood, right? Knowledge of and respect for biology, right? So knowledge of the natural cycle, respect for the natural cycle, working with that natural cycle that God has designed such that women are not fertile most of the time. And through self-control, the second part of responsible parenthood. So through knowledge and self-control, the couple avoids pregnancy through abstinence during fertile periods. With respect to the intention, I think it's worth pointing out that there's a common intention, right? So the couple using NFP, the couple using direct contraception sterilization, it's true that both are trying to avoid pregnancy. NFP can also be used to achieve pregnancy, but here we're talking about cases when it's being used to avoid pregnancy. So the intention to avoid pregnancy is not problematic. Humani Vitae specifically says that couples can intend to avoid pregnancy. As we saw with responsible parenthood, sometimes promoting the goods of the family and procreation means prudentially avoiding pregnancy for the time being. So this is in accord with prudence here, that this can be a permissible intention. But as we've said, the problematic intention with direct contraception and sterilization is this additional intention, the intention to render a fertile act infertile. So the means, so even if the end is the same, to avoid pregnancy, the means is different. Here, the means is to render a fertile act infertile. Versus, again, the means in NFP is to use knowledge and self-control in order to avoid pregnancy. The circumstances, notably, can be very similar, right? So I'm not going to say at all that there aren't couples using direct contraception sterilization who don't have really good reasons for avoiding pregnancy. I'm sure that many of them do have good reasons for avoiding pregnancy. So circumstances don't necessarily distinguish the two, morally speaking, but as we've noted, to be permissible, using natural family planning to avoid pregnancy, the couples must have well-grounded or just reasons to avoid pregnancy. And then just sort of filling in the intention part, just going off of that, as well, again, to be permissible, there must be intention to promote other goods, right? So it has to be the well-grounded reasons. I think the well-grounded reasons have to be involved, the promotion of other goods for the family, rather than some sort of frivolous or selfish reasons. Okay, so far, we've seen that Catholic couples are not called to have as many children as they are physically able to have, but rather they're called to responsible parenthood. We also saw that if they have well-grounded or just reasons to avoid pregnancy, they may use natural family planning to avoid pregnancy. And as we've seen, these methods of natural family planning differ both medically and morally from direct contraception sterilization. But now to complicate things a bit, the Catholic Church also teaches that indirect contraception or sterilization may be morally permissible. So here's what Humani Vitae says. On the other hand, the Church does not consider at all illicit the use of those therapeutic means necessary to cure bodily diseases, even if a foreseeable impediment to procreation should result therefrom, provided such impediment is not directly intended for any motive whatsoever. But didn't I say that Catholic teaching is that direct contraception sterilization is intrinsically evil, wrong in all circumstances? I did. The Church does teach this. But the church is making a further moral distinction here between direct and indirect actions against goods, the latter of which can be morally permissible. So underlying this moral distinction between direct and indirect actions against goods is the principle of double effect. I think for the sake of time, I'll pass over it for now, which I sort of regret, but I want to sort of cover everything. But then if you're interested, we can come back to it during the Q&A. So you'll kind of see the slides as they go through. But again, the principle that helps us to make this distinction between direct and indirect actions against goods, including the good of procreation. Okay, so maybe don't look. No, you can look. Okay, but I'm going to skip forward. I want to say something about this distinction, right? So I'm going to put it in this chart form, something you're already familiar with, right? So I think even looking at it, object intended circumstances, it becomes more clear as well what this moral distinction is. So the direct contraception and sterilization side is the same as what you saw in the other chart, comparing it to NFP to avoid pregnancy. The other side here is indirect contraception or sterilization, right? So the object, in this case, what's being done is that the woman is taking a medication or undergoing a procedure that results in sterility. That's what's being done. The intention, so it's important that in order to be permissible, the sole intention must be to alleviate a pathology. So it can't be the case, and if we go back to principle of double effect, you'll see it more clearly. It can't be the case that she intends to alleviate some pathology, but also intends to avoid pregnancy. So she has to intend only the good effect in this case, only the cure or alleviation of a pathology. And then the circumstances as well, again, they could be the same. They could look similar on both sides. But again, in order for it to be permissible, the pathology must be in some way proportionately serious to that effect that is going to to the sterility that results as well. And it must be recommended from a medical perspective as well. So we have to think about whether there are other treatments available to accomplish the same alleviation or cure of the pathology that the woman is suffering. Okay, so like I said, I regret that we had to sort of skip over some of the more detail there as far as the reasoning goes, but hopefully that gives you at least some taste of how the church understands this distinction here. All right, so again, to summarize, we've seen that Catholic couples are called to responsible parenthood, not to have as many children as they're physically able to. If they have well-grounded or just reasons to avoid, they may use natural family planning to avoid pregnancy. And as we've seen, again, these methods differ medically and morally from direct contraception and sterilization. And then lastly, we saw in brief that indirect contraception or sterilization can be morally permissible. Even if I would, from a medical perspective, recommend that women, for instance, who are recommended birth control to treat hormonal acne, even if it can be morally permissible, medically, I'm not a doctor, but I would still recommend from the perspective I'm able to offer, having worked in healthcare, that women seek treatment from doctors who are going to take the time to investigate root causes and to try to address the root causes. So I do think that even if it's morally permissible, in my view, I think it would very rarely be the best treatment, not just from a moral perspective, but also from a medical perspective. Okay, we can say more. So if you have questions, we can say more during the Q&A. But I want to make sure I at least have time to go through some of the reasoning. So what's the why behind this teaching? Humanae vitae, again, same letter that we've seen come up a number of times here, is a really important document in Catholic teaching here. So it's published during a time when there's a lot of anticipation that the Catholic Church is going to change its position on contraception, on direct contraception and sterilization. But in fact, it doesn't. It does not change the position. At this time, many of the Protestant denominations are changing the teaching. Historically, both Catholic and Protestant churches taught against direct contraception and sterilization. And so again, sort of anticipated the church is going to change its teaching, but it doesn't. And instead, Paul VI reaffirms the traditional teaching, but it also gives more reasoning than has previously been given. So prior, what I've already said about acting against the natural ordering of the act, so if you look at, for instance, Casti Canubi, another encyclical having to do with the good of marriage, the goods of marriage. That's the way it talks about it. It doesn't go into more detail. So Humanae Vitae begins to expand the reasoning to help us to more deeply understand why the church teaches what it does. So here's one of the sort of core principles. Humanae Vitae says, each and every marital act must of necessity retain its intrinsic relationship to the procreation of human life. Okay, we've seen that before, right? But it says it's based on the inseparable connection established by God, which man on his own initiative may not break, between the unitive significance and the procreative significance, which are both inherent in the marriage act. So again, the marital act, I'll come back to this. So the marital act is understood to have these two inherent dimensions, right? So this is the ordering of the marital act, is that it's ordered towards both procreation and the union of the couple. And it's what Humanae Vitae is saying is that God established it this way. And so it's wrong for us to act contrary to God's will and to separate either the unitive or the procreative dimension. Another point which is not made explicit in Humanae Vitae, but I think there's a lot of power here. So it talks about responsible parenthood. It never applies what it says about responsible parenthood directly to the contraception question. It's kind of interesting because to my mind, it seems that the teaching of responsible parenthood is really helpful in understanding not only the difference between direct contraception, sterilization, and natural family planning, but also in terms of understanding the reasoning. So just briefly, and again, we can look at this in more detail, but if we take what Humanae Vitae says about responsible parenthood and we sort of assess direct contraception, sterilization under this lens. So here are the four components again that you saw earlier. So awareness of and respect for the proper functions of biological processes. So I think that we can't deny, right, that pharmaceutical companies, doctors have some knowledge of the biological processes, otherwise they wouldn't have created effective contraceptives, right, or sterilization methods. So they have some knowledge, but actually they typically lack a lot of the detailed knowledge about the biomarkers for fertility, for example. So there's some knowledge that I think they lack that natural family planning has. And the respect for seems to be a missing part as well, right? Because instead of supporting the natural biological processes, the medication or procedures are seeking to undermine the natural processes, right? So the natural process is aimed at fertility, and these are all trying to undermine the natural process. Second step, control of the reason and the will over drives and emotions. So, again, I don't think we have to deny that, you know, there's not some exercise of self-control, right, involved. So, part of the reason why birth control pills are not actually that effective in practice is because it's hard to remember to take a pill every day. I'm just the worst. Like, even I set a reminder on my phone and I still, right? So it's hard. There has to be some self-control there. But I think hopefully, fairly obviously, the self-control involved in practicing natural family planning is far greater. And if you're not convinced, then ask yourself, right? So I often have people saying, there's no difference. And if you ask a question like, okay, well, why don't you try natural family planning? No thanks. Why not? Because it's hard, right? So I think there's obviously a difference there in terms of the self-control that's required. Again, the prudential discernment could look similar. So I don't think that necessarily distinguishes the two. But then again, discernment based on an objective moral order, as Humanae Vitae says, is contrary to the order established by God. So I think this helps to give us some additional reasoning as far as why the church teaches against direct contraception, sterilization. To go further into the reasoning, so we're talking about God's law, right? How God designed the sexual act. In the Catholic tradition, we understand that God's law is not arbitrary, rather it's for our good. So what more can we say about why it's for our good? So Humanae Vitae, as well as John Paul II's Theology of the Body, go into some more detail on this. And specifically, they point to how direct contraception and sterilization undermine truth and love in the marital relationship. So Humanae Vitae says, quote, and if each of these two essential qualities is preserved, it's talking about the unitive and procreative qualities, the use of marriage fully retains its sense of true mutual love and its ordination to the supreme responsibility of parenthood. So unitive and procreation are not only the essential qualities, essential dimensions of the conjugal act, but they're also essential to conjugal love, is what's being said here. Humani Vitae points to the fact that even in our culture, and this was true in 1968, I think it's also true today, that there's sort of a cultural understanding that if the unitive dimension is undermined, it's not an act of love, right? So whether in marriage or outside of marriage, right, if there's a violation of the unitive dimension, if sex is forced on the other person, again, whether outside of marriage or inside of marriage, that this undermines the unitive dimension and it can't be an act of love. So Humani Vitae says, men rightly observe that a conjugal act imposed on one's partner without regard to his or her condition or personal and reasonable wishes in the matter is no true act of love, and therefore offends the moral order in its particular application to the intimate relationship of husband and wife. So I think that first part is not controversial, right? So there's an understanding that if we act against the unitive dimension, then it's not really an act of love. The second part, right, the opposite side of it, is going to be a lot more controversial. And interestingly enough, Humani Vitae says the first two parts and then doesn't make this conclusion. It doesn't give us this last part. But John Paul II in Theology of the Body does. If the procreative dimension is undermined, then it's not really an act of love. And this, again, it flows from the same principle that these two components, these two dimensions, qualities of conjugal intercourse are essential. So neither of them can be taken away without undermining the love of the couple. So here's a quote from Theology of the Body, which points to this. In the conjugal act, it is not licit to separate artificially. I don't like that he uses the term artificially there. You probably know why at this point. But to separate artificially in a way contrary to the natural ordering of the act, the unitive meaning from the procreative meaning, because the one as well as the other belong to the innermost truth of the conjugal act. The one is realized together with the other and in a certain way, the one through the other. Thus, in such a case, when the conjugal act is deprived of its inner truth because it is deprived artificially of its procreative capacity, it also ceases to be an act of love. So again, he's drawing that second conclusion there, that if the procreative dimension is intentionally undermined, then it's not really an act of love. And again, we see here that he's linking love and truth, right? So there's a way in which... what he's saying here, right, is that sexual intercourse is an action which communicates the total self-gift of the spouses to each other. And so if there's not a total self-gift because the procreative dimension is intentionally withheld, then there's a dishonesty about the act. But what he's saying here is that it's not just any sort of lie, right? It's not just any sort of dishonest statement or act, but it's a lie that's at the level of the truth of marital love and the truth of the person. Just to say a bit more about how John Paul II speaks about love. So he starts just talking about love in general as including God's love, right, as reciprocal self-gift. So this giving and receiving of the self to the other. So all love, love between God and us, love between parents and child, love between friends, love between spouses, right? So all love has that in common, that it involves a kind of reciprocal self-gift. Of course, what that gift looks like depends on the type of love. And all reciprocal self-gift, John Paul II says, is unitive and procreative in a broad sense, right? So unitive, again, is going to look different depending on the relationship. And procreative, in a broad sense, meaning, you know, life-giving in some way. But marital love, so it has these components that we've seen, right? Including as expressed through the sexual act within marriage. But then the sexual act expresses these two dimensions in a completely unique way that we don't see in any other act. Because the unitive dimension is total, and there's a total self-gift. And the procreative dimension becomes specific, right? As an act which is which is ordered toward, even if most of the time, like we said, it doesn't result in, but ordered toward the procreation, conception of a child. Okay, so again, the lie then at the level of the truth of the person and the truth of marital love is that the act expresses this total self-gift. But at the same time, there's a withholding of the totality of the gift, specifically the fertility. John Paul II does clarify that he thinks there is obviously a unitive dimension still, right? And when couples are using direct contraception or sterilization. But again, he emphasizes that undermining that the procreative dimension is contrary to the inner truth of, in this case, he's going to call it, I'll read it in a moment, personal communion. Sometimes he uses personal communion interchangeably with reciprocal self-gift, which he uses interchangeably with love. So personal communion, reciprocal self-gift, love, he uses all these terms interchangeably. And specifically, he's going to say that if the truth is lacking, then there's not a true giving or receiving the truth of the person. So here's what he says in 123.7. One can say that in the case of artificial separation, again, I'm not a fan of the artificial word there, might just be the English translation, though. So the artificial separation of these two meanings in the conjugal act, a real bodily union is brought about, but it does not correspond to the inner truth and dignity of personal communion. This communion demands, in fact, that the language of the body be expressed reciprocally in the integral truth of its meaning. If this truth is lacking, one can speak neither of the truth of the reciprocal gift of self, nor of the reciprocal acceptance of oneself by the person. Such a violation of the inner order of conjugal communion, a communion that plunges its roots into the very order of the person, constitutes the essential evil of the contraceptive act. So here, I think one way of drawing out what he's saying here, if we think about direct contraception as a sin, it's not just a sin against the body, right? So it's not just a problem that it disrupts some natural ordering of the body. But what he's saying here is that it's a sin against the person. It's a sin against the marriage covenant, against the communion of persons of the marriage. Pass over that for now, but we can always come back to it. So I want to end with a final insight from Theology of the Body, which I think is particularly insightful and powerful, but for some reason it gets almost no attention when you hear about, you know, John Paul II's Theology of the Body. But I think it's actually also connected with what Paul VI suggests in Humanae Vitae regarding responsible parenthood, specifically the second component about self-control. So what John Paul II says is that one of the problems with direct contraception sterilization is that it replaces mastery over self with domination of the forces of nature in the sexual sphere. So what should be, he says, in the realm of self-mastery, the sexual sphere should be, he says, in the realm of self-mastery for human persons within marriage. But instead, it's placed in the realm of domination. And then he further points to some risks for the human person here, right? So he says that this extension of the sphere of domination threatens the human person. So when we put something in the realm of domination, which should be in the sphere of self-mastery, then we have the risk of turning the person into an object of manipulation. So we can explore that more in the Q&A if you're interested. So again, connected, I think, to that second component of responsible parenthood, the importance of the self-mastery, the self-control aspect, and where that's missing, and how there's a great risk there to the human person. John Paul II also links this insight regarding self-mastery back to the idea of how direct contraception or sterilization undermines truth and love. So specifically, he says that man is person precisely because he possesses himself and has domination over himself. So this is part of what defines us as human persons, is having this self-mastery over ourselves. Animals don't have this. So man is a person precisely because he possesses himself and has domination over himself. Indeed, inasmuch as he is master over himself, can he give himself to another. So we can't give ourselves to others if we don't have self-mastery over ourselves. Of course, we're all going to have this imperfectly, right, as humans. But the degree to which we have self-mastery over ourselves is the degree to which we can give ourselves to other persons. And so, again, we can't give of ourselves in any relationship, right, but also in marriage, if we don't have self-mastery, if we don't possess ourselves. And just by adding this specifically theological dimension to thinking about that why, right, so why is it a problem to separate the procreative and unitive dimensions? So again, this isn't explicit in Humani Vitae, but Humani Vitae does remind us that Christian marriage, sacramental marriage, represents the union of Christ and his church. So this is what marital love is, an image of God's love. Big responsibility. Not that it always is, unfortunately, right? But that this is what married couples are called to. They're called to image God's love, which, just like we talked about, is unitive and procreative, just like other forms of love, right? That's the model. That God's love is unitive and procreative. And so if we think about marital love as imaging God's love, that's the responsibility here. And again, the sexual act within marriage as a particular expression, a very unique expression of marital love and therefore of God's love, then again, if the procreative dimension is intentionally removed, then we can speak about direct contraception, sterilization, as a distortion of that image of God's love, since God's love, again, is procreative as well as unitive. All right, I will end there for today, but hopefully we still have some time for Q&A, so I'm happy to fill in some of the things we skipped over or answer other questions that you all have. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.